Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Patricia Smith. Patricia Smith is the author of the 2005 National Poetry Series winner, Tea House of the Almighty, as well as the books Close to Death, Big Towns, Big Talk, and Life According to Motown. She is the most successful competitor in the history of the Poetry Slam, having won the National Individual Championship 4 times. In addition to her poetry books, Patricia has penned Africans in America, the companion book to the groundbreaking PBS series, and the children's book, Jana and the Kings. She is a Cave Canem faculty member and a former McEver Chair in Writing at Georgia Tech University. Patricia Smith has written and performed 2 one-woman plays, one of which was produced by Derek Walcott's Trinidad Theater Workshop. Her poems have been published in the Paris Review, Tri-Quarterly, Agni, and other literary journals. And we're happy to have you here.
Thanks.
After all that, that's a lot of bio, and there's a lot that was cut.
I should be tired, huh?
That's right, are you? Okay. You're going to start with some poems from your new book.
Sure. Actually, this is the first poem in Tea House, and it's also the first poem I do whenever I'm doing readings. And the reason I do that, it's a piece that reminds me of why I started writing poetry in the first place. Every year, actually I didn't do it this year, but my last year was last year. I do a residency with a group of 6th graders in Miami, and I've gotten to go every year and watch them grow up and everything. But the very first time that I went, the area that I go to is a high incidence of drug use. So a lot of the kids have lost parents or siblings to AIDS. And I come bounding in saying, "Hi, I'm here to teach you poetry." And I get this whole classroom of kids looking at me like, "Oh, that's all well and good, but how can you make our lives better?" And my first time, there was a little girl there, and her mother had just died the week before. And she was already back in school. And I think about how, you know, sometimes when something happens and they fly in psychologists and everything, but this was just not that kind of school. And she wanted me to teach her to write a poem about her mother. And it makes me realize how powerful the words are, that they have the power to move us from one place in our head to a safer place, which is what she was asking me to help her do. So this is a poem dedicated to the 6th grade class at Lily C. Evans Elementary School in Dade County, Miami, which they made me promise to say every time I did the poem. I am astonished at their mouthful names. Lakanisha, Chevalane, DeLeo, Fumaleo. Their ragged rebellions and lip gloss pouts and all those pants drooped as drapery. I rejoice when they kiss my face, whisper wet and urgent in my ear, make me their obsession because I have brought them poetry. They shout me raw, bruise my wrist with their pulling, and brashly claim me as mama as they cradle my head in their little laps, waiting for new words to grow in my mouth. You. 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 Angry, jubilant, weeping poets, we are all saviors, reluctant hosannas in the limelight, but you knew that, didn't you? So let us bless this 6th grade class. 40 cracking voices, 40 nappy heads, and all of them raise their hands when I ask. They have all seen the Reaper, grim in his heavy robe, pushing the button for the dead project elevator, begging for a break at the corner pawn shop, cackling wildly in the back pew of the Baptist church. I ask the death question, and 40 fists punch the air. Me! Me! An O'Neill matchstick crack child watched his mother's body become a claw. And 9-year-old Tico Jefferson, barely big enough to lift the gun, fired a bullet into his throat when Mama bended his back with a lead pipe. Tamika cried into a sofa pillow when Daddy blasted Mama into the north wall of their cluttered one-room apartment. Danya's cousin, gone in a drive-by. Dark window, click, click, gone, says Danya, her tiny finger a barrel, the thumb a hammer. I am astonished at their losses. And yet when I read a poem about my own hard-eyed teenager, Jeffrey asks, is he dead yet? Cannot be comprehended. an 18-year-old still pushing and pulling his own breath. And 40 faces pity me, knowing that I will soon be as they are, numb to our bloodied histories, favoring the Reaper with a thumbs up and a wink, hearing the question and shouting, me, Miss Smith, I know somebody dead. Can poetry hurt us, they ask me, before crawling into my words to sleep. I love you, Nicole says. Nicole wearing my face, pimples peppering her nose, and she is as black as angels are. Nicole's braids kissed with match flame to seal them. And can you teach me to write a poem about my mama, Miss Smith? I mean, you write about your daddy, and he's dead. Can you teach me to remember my mama? A teacher tells me this is the first time Nicole has admitted that her mother is gone. Murdered by slim silver needles and a stranger rifling through her blood, the virus pushing her skeleton through for Nicole to see. And now this child with rusty knees and mismatched shoes sees poetry as her scream and asks me for the words to build her mother again, replacing the voice, stitching on the lost flesh. So poets, as we take the stage, as we flirt and sin and rejoice behind microphones, remember Nicole. She knows that we are here now, and she is an empty vessel waiting to be filled. And she is waiting. And she's waiting. And she waits.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Patricia Smith, reading from her new book, Tea House of the Almighty. But actually, if you were here, you could see that she's reciting and not reading at all. That's such a strong poem. I want to ask you how you walk out of that room and what it's like for you in the moment, hearing all that and then leaving.
What I've been trying to do, I mean, one of the reasons I was coming back for 10 years is I didn't want to leave. It's hard for me to, I think back to myself in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, and I got through my entire elementary school career, high school career, without someone who was impassioned about creative work coming and standing in front of the class and saying, this is a viable option for you, not only career-wise, but also in your personal life. This is a way to help you process your life and move it forward. You can do that through words. And if that had happened, my life would have been changed that much sooner. So it's really hard for me, especially when you go into schools and underserved communities, and the kids, you're their mother all of a sudden. They're clinging to your legs, or they kept chasing you in the halls. They want to know what you're going to do afterwards. Can you come home with me? Can I go home with you? And that's a very difficult situation to extract yourself from. So when I go in, I make sure that they know that whatever we're working on, there will be follow through. Mm-hmm. Whether I have to come mm-hmm. back, whether you send it to me and I will respond and write feedback and send it back to you. I always make sure there's some way that they can get in touch with me. But that following year, it was supposed to be a one-shot thing. A teacher overheard her saying that she couldn't get any funding for people to come into her class. And I said, well, if you can get me there and give me some place to sleep, I'll come. So the first time I came, she held bake sales and did everything, and I slept on her floor in her house. But I think that's kind of a commitment that every poet has to make. I mean, what's your agenda? Are you doing this because you want a recording contract? Do you want to be in a movie? Do you want to be famous? Is it some combination of that? Or do you want to look at an audience and see yourself there hungry at an age where you're very vulnerable? And, and so that's what I see. So I try, even if I walk out of the classroom physically, I try to stay accessible to the kids, so much so that, Nicole, the girl in the poem, is now at Florida State.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, it happened to, and I just kept in touch with her.
Nice. Okay, more poems, please.
More poems, please. No one ever says more poems, please, to me. I'm just, amazed. Okay, my favorite segment of the population are old black men, because you can't get away with anything. They've done everything already. So if you go to an old black guy and you say, oh, I was on the internet, and they go,
the internet. I had the internet back in, what was it? What, that worldwide thing back in 42? We had that, girl. You ain't done, you know. So no matter what you bring up, they've already done it. So this is a poem for John Lee Hooker. And it's called How to Be a Lecherous Little Old Black Man and Make Lots of Money. First, you got to get the blues. This is easy if you are a person of any gender and possess a pulse, a cheating lover, a stalking ex-lover, a used Yugo, a pumping heart, an empty wallet, a half-dead dog, an empty refrigerator, one last cigarette butt, a good memory, a nosy mama, a lonely room, a quick trigger, roving eyes, an addiction to whiskey, nothing but the clothes on your back, a Jones for your neighbor's wife, a Jones for your wife's neighbor, a positive test result, an itching to leave, an itching to stay, or any itching where there shouldn't be one. Rub your hands slow over your body, feel the valleys and the wrongs. Let misery chomp your spine toward collapsing. Let it fold your whole self double. Then you can walk like John Lee Hooker do. Click, shuffle, bent over, nose to the ground, wearing a cock-brim felt fedora that wouldn't dare fall off. Then you can think like John Lee do. I'm old as Victrola. Gotta buy a bottle of Mrs. Butterworth if I want to feel a woman. But I can still sing better than you. Mrs. Butterworth still have the body? Sorry. Okay, good.
Because yeah, as far as we know.
Yeah, that's how I found out about women's bodies. My Mrs. But never mind, it's a whole other story. And I'm going to read another poem from the book. It's like I knew what it... I start to feel, go through changes when I'm reading where I have something I want to read, but then it starts to feel good and I go, I'll read something else. Oh, okay. I'll read this. This is for the Republican Party. It's called Giving Birth to Soldiers. And it starts with a little news item. February 1st, 2005. Tabitha Bonilla's husband, Army Captain Orlando A. Bonilla, 27, was killed Wednesday in a helicopter accident in Baghdad. Her father, Army Sergeant First Class Henry A. Bacon, 45, died in Iraq last February. She will pin ponderous medals to her house dress, dripping the repeated roses, while she claws through boxes filled with him and then him. The accepting of God's weird wisdom takes place over forkfuls of rubbery casseroles and the snowy vows of newsmen who measure her worth in cued weeping. She offers her husband's hands, a shrine of their mingled smells, a warm seat on a couch of napped corduroy. They offer one polished bone scrubbed clean of war. And she babbles of links and irony, shrugs her numb shoulders, and feels dimly blessed as a door slams shut on both sides of her head. Suddenly, she is her only history. Smiling politely beneath a fierce salute, propped upright behind the crumpled ghost of her men, she is the catchy logo for a confounded country. This day is the day she has. Tomorrow, she will touch her own breast. She will dismantle a gaudy altar with her teeth. And she will ask a bemused God for guidance as she steps back into line, her womb tingling vaguely with the next soldier. I have a granddaughter, and she's 11, and she's blooming like crazy. It's just things are popping and things are bigger, and it's just amazing. So when she got her first bra, I decided to celebrate it. And this is called First Bra Villanelle. Your boobies bloom, your hips prepare to sway. You swirl, sleek-skinned in mirrors, so amazed. This stunning turn will change the way you play. Your arms still flail, your gangly limbs still splay like stars, but woman is the child I raise. Your boobies bloom, your hips prepare to sway. Sweet dervish, tumbler, veering off to stray through childhood's chaos, life as swirl and haze, its stunning turns. Don't change the way you play.
Sit in my arms and listen while I say what mothers say. I dread the looming days, your boobies bloom, your hips. Prepare to sway back to this, toward me, toward more weird days of dismembered Barbies, of girlish craze. No stunning turns to change the way you play. With heart squeezed shut, I warn you of the way young boys will stumble dizzy toward your blaze. Your boobies bloom, your hips prepare to sway. This stunning turn will change the way you play.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Patricia Smith. I don't think I've ever heard of First Bra Villanelle before.
Well, kind of, what's happened to me, really, it's an amazing thing. I got introduced to poetry by getting up on stage and doing it. So I've gone through all this kind of hard, you know, reading in bars, and, you know, I've developed this confidence. No matter where, you know, I walk into some place, they go, no mic. I say, no problem. They say, there's a group of bikers in the back that don't want to hear poetry. I say, no problem. You know, but now I've decided to enter an MFA program. So what my goal with this whole program was to have my options broadened. So when I sit down to write a poem and the poem is suggesting to me a sonnet or villanelle, which are not options I had available to me before, or at least they were options I was very uncomfortable with. And now I'd say, oh, I hear a rhythm in that, and it wants to be a villanelle. Okay. And a lot of it is just kind of me. You know, when you first discover something, you write everything. I have like 20 villanelles now. And some of them are good, and some of them aren't. But it just seemed to be perfect, because mm-hmm. the boobies blooming and preparing to sway came to me. And I said, oh, those are easy words to, you know, to rhyme and to stick in a structure, you know, mm-hmm. so, and she loves it. She's like, read it. She's in the audience. Read that thing about my boobs. Okay. Yeah.
And the bikers in the back are like, read
that. The
bikers
in the back, like, oh no, please don't do that.
I want to ask you about what you just said about just, you started by just getting up and reading.
Mm-hmm.
Is that literal, what you're saying, that you didn't study poetry?
I never walked into a classroom and discussed or studied poetry. I had gone to a huge, I'm originally from Chicago, I'd gone to a poetry festival. There were 50 poets in a blues club over the course of a winter afternoon, and it was supposed to bring together academic poets and street poets. And I got some people together, basically, and said, oh, a bar, 5 hours, let's go get drunk and laugh at the poets. And I found out there was this really vibrant literary community. Like, if you say you're impassioned about writing, you should want to write in as many ways as possible. So right there, you know. So I hooked up with somebody who knew, took me around to a bunch of open mics, and eventually I just got up on stage. And that, to me, what poetry was. It was always in the faces and ears of an audience. It was easy enough, so when you got off stage, people wanted to discuss the work with you right away. They'd say, I hated that, I love that, this is why. So it's always been kind of this energetic give and take. So the idea of sitting in a room and writing things and sending them off to literary magazines and then waiting for somebody to stamp you legitimate never really worked for me. I just never. So then when I started being asked to teach, I realized it's something that I really want to do. So the thing at Georgia Tech, for instance, I couldn't teach the whole year because I didn't have an MFA. And so I said, you know, I don't want to run into that again. So mm-hmm. while it would seem like I'm just getting the MFA so I can get the paper so I could teach, I'm really enjoying this. I'm enjoying backing up and learning not only what poets are important, but why, so I don't have to fake my way through conversations anymore. Having these structures open up to me and not being so heavy-handed or feeling like they don't feel like assignments. It feels like I'm opening my voice up more. And I think it was the perfect route for me to take, to do all the, you know, the hard scrabble stuff first, mm-hmm. and then to come into the classroom with the things I've learned, which is much more than I thought I had learned.
Mm-hmm.
But the things I know, it puts me in another kind of space, and I'm really celebrating this new knowledge that I have.
I mean, that's a really great outlook, but you're such a wonderful poet. I mean, don't you think they should say, yes, please teach at our university. Forget the MFA.
Well, the way it happened, you know, when I decided where I was going to apply, I had a good friend of mine call me up and say, well, you're not paying for it, are you? And I said, well, yeah, of course. And my husband and I had sat down and worked this whole thing out. And he said, no. He said, when you get to a certain point and you've published and they want your name aligned with their program,
That's for
which
sure.
was a whole new thing
yeah.
for me. And while that would be really nice, I would probably say, let me finish.
Mm-hmm.
I just really, it's such a joyous place for me right now. Of course, there's little things that I don't like sleeping in the dorm and all the perky 20-year-olds doing their hair in the morning and one toilet and one shower and a key card to get in and out of my room. I'm not happy. But non-Western forms and mm-hmm. actually having these great conversations every night. And
yeah.
It's been wonderful. So I do feel like there's things that are being filled in mm-hmm. that I kind of skipped over. And even there was always a little nagging feeling in my head where we had this great insular community, which was fun and wonderful and taught me a lot. But every once in a while, we get this glimpse at this other community, and you wonder if you're truly legitimate as a mm-hmm. poet by ignoring this other community, which, for lack of a better term, I'd say academic community completely.
Right, right.
You know, and being the rebels over here. But,
right.
And we're all doing the same thing.
Right.
I figured that out.
Okay. More poems, please. I'll say it again.
sure. This is from another book. This is from Big Town's Big Talk. And I actually discovered this poem again about an hour and a half ago. The thing about a book, you put it together and you've lived with the poems for so long, you put it aside, it's like, oh God, thank God that's gone. And you don't look at them. And I was like, hey, I really like this, so I'm going to read it. This is for Gloria Lynn. Gloria Lynn is a vocalist and a very cool kind of 50s, 60s jazzy blues vocalist. And I went to see her sing live, and she finished up with this song, and she held the last note in the song for like 2 days. So that's what this poem is. It's called On the Street Where She Lives. She jumped right on that last note in On the Street Where You Live, and in that verb's defiant tremble, my ears lost the power to receive and translate. I tugged, pulled, sought at the connection, but it would not break. My eyes were locked on the thin miracle her throat was, the one note bending, snapping, searing the hairs on my neck, and still that one note, the exquisite shiver of a common word, long and relentless with you can kiss my sequined black ass bravado. I flailed in my seat, spilled my whiskey, and still she held it. A cool line of live, a furious in-my-face live, an undeniably live live, and me without a stitch of armor. Long time ago, when my daddy blew hot music into my ear, why didn't he tell me about this? Miss Gloria, conjurer woman, on the street where you live, the houses sport dips in their red brick hips, and their doors are open mouths, scatting songs threaded with sweet sin, songs Daddy used to hum to rock me to sleep. On the street where you live, time passes in two-step with a tap of its snakeskins clickers. The sun blazes blue and doesn't go down till it feels like it. The streetlights jazz through their colors, and big flashy cars bend backwards like late-night movie dancers. She rides that last note in on the street where you live, and somehow you just know that on the street where she lives, no one is ever home. They've all left to dance like fools on the boulevard, feeling that long, slow steaming in their souls, just like I feel right now. A while ago, I went to Paris to read poetry, and I was so green at that point. It was just great to be in Paris. And you know how when Americans visit another country, they try to pretend like they already know everything? Like, oh, that would be the, oh, yes, I believe that, you know, and you're looking at them like, you don't know anything. So this is, my friend and I went to the Louvre, and we were like the bad girls. They had to chase, we were like leaning over the barriers, touching the paintings, and taking flash pictures of precious works of art that are supposed to crumble if you take flash pictures. Like, we didn't care. So this is about that joy of discovery and admitting that you don't know everything. And it's really good to just do things for the first time. It's called Doing the Louvre. You're a junkie just like I am. After we've dumped your husband in the Louvre's cafe to sip the steaming tea and chew on his poetry, we're off like schoolgirls, screeching in duet, dazzled by the bright eternal gasp of ancient things. We've got no business here, homegirl and compañera. We've got no business closing our mouths around this sharp, exquisite language or savoring the sweet tongue squeeze of pastries, shining cakes, and shaved chocolates. We're of simpler stock, City and country dust, collard greens, moon pies, bullet holes, and basement slow dances. We are shamelessly American, rough street girls with rusty knees, the flip side of cocky Parisian wisp and slim cashmere coats the color of tobacco. Girlfriend, you and I are too much scream for this place, but you're a junkie just like I am. Too long denied access to official beauty, we walk these streets with our mouths open and faces tilted up, swallowing everything, swallowing it all, much too much scenery and sound for our thin American throats. We gawk at cathedrals with their gargoyles bleached to an eerie snarl by bright slashes of moon. Say goodbye when we mean yes. Good morning when we mean how much. Ask for bread when we need the toilet. We are amazed that no one is asking for all of this back, that we are allowed to bask in this city's light. I can still hear my mama, as plain and practical as a cast iron skillet. Child, you need to stop all that foolishness over there in some France where you don't know nothing or nobody. Ain't no black folks over there know how. But I know you, old friend, with your bright, burnished tangle of hair and deep laugh, and right now these halls belong to us. There are bad girls loose in the Louvre, girls soft as gunshots, girls nourished and fueled by silvers, silks, and the stone gaze of Napoleon. We laugh at the smashed noses of Egyptian rulers, stare at the tiny mummified feet of a young girl, mistake Goya for Gauguin, and rub what surfaces we can, including the marble privates of towering deities. When we say things like, "Hey, I think I said that on a postcard once," or, "Do you know how old this thing is? How can the world help but love us?" we would give Venus our arms. After 8 hours, clicking our hungry heels and snapping illicit flash photos in dark halls brimming with ancient music, we finally find the Mona Lisa, alone, caged in antiseptic behind that glass every woman wears, and we wonder how best to free her, knowing she's a junkie just like we are. She longs for our wild voices, our naive, accidental beauty. She's aching to ditch that frame and skip these hallowed halls with the homegirls, mistake the obscene for the exquisite, and gaze at unsolved mysteries that just for once are not her own.
It's the poetry of Patricia Smith. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you are welcome. It's so much fun.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lauren Wolf and Joseph Wilk. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that curved. She had a smile.